Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch, and from Fairbanks by telephone, Dermot Cole, columnist of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. Well, the soap opera continues. Former Palin staffer Frank Bailey has written a book, and the book has created controversy, and so has the manner in which it was released, or at least parts of it were released. Paul, this may be a difficult story to summarize, but please start for us.
It's actually not that hard. You start out by saying, "Hi, I'm Frank Bailey. I was a close personal aide to Sarah Palin, former governor of the state of Alaska. Turns out she's a whack job. I didn't know it at the time. I found Jesus, everything is better now, and somebody stole my book."
Okay, and somebody stole my book. You might explain that, and was well, a little bit more specific than whack job?
Well, she apparently was mean to her children. He was very close to her, I guess, on a personal level.
So he alleges.
He alleges, of course. Alleges, I think it's been seen elsewhere as well. He does not paint a flattering picture of the Palin family or Governor Sarah Palin. And at the end of the day, somebody got a hold of his manuscript and released it to several news outlets. And it's been reprinted pretty much everywhere. Everybody's gotten to take a look at it.
Jill, two questions for you. Are readers of the manuscript, or the parts of it we've seen, learning anything new about the Palins and the manner of the release? It is an unusual one, to say the least.
Right. Well, we can start with, you know, what we're learning or what's being reinforced about Palin that we've heard in the past. I think that Bailey isn't necessarily offering anything that's glaringly new. It may fall on common themes that we've already known about, that the former governor was known to be vindictive in petty fights that her staff sometimes felt were not appropriate for the governor to sink to her level to, that they would try to influence media polls when there were polls out about, you know, what do you think about Governor Palin on this subject or that subject. And the most alarming, perhaps, is an allegation of illegality regarding some collusion between the governor's office and the Republican Governors Association, I believe, where they kind of set up and staged some shooting opportunities to create some commercials and some involvement of related individuals in state government connected to that effort. I don't know that anything's come of that or that anything will. So, I don't know. Personally, I think it's just more of the same with a little bit different color and from an insider who was definitely close to Palin during some of these key years and who claims to have access to a great number of emails that went back and forth that not only have not yet been seen, but also to which state government doesn't have access and therefore can't produce in some of these public records.
And Joe McGinnis
requests.
Not only became her neighbor, he plays a role in this story.
Right. So we have
a professional writer, Joe McGinnis.
We have a professional writer and a rival author who has produced his own piece of work regarding Sarah Palin that's due for release this coming September. And he appears to, in part anyway, be the point of release of this unfinished and as of yet unpublished manuscript, much to the consternation of Mr. Bailey and his co-authors, a local blogger, Jeannie Devon, and another author, Ken Morris. So it's strange. You know, I don't know why a rival author floats to members of the media an unpublished manuscript. Is it vindictiveness?
It certainly does create more publicity and gets the name Palin
out there.
Right.
Is it self-promotion? Is it a publicity stunt? Is it a stick it to you for the, you know, who knows?
Okay, let's get Dermot Cole in here. Dermot, does anything that we've seen in the Bailey book or the Bailey manuscript, I need to call it, have any bearing on Sarah Palin's political future?
Well, you know, Mike, that's almost impossible to predict at this point because everything about her remains impossible to predict. What's looming is her coming trip to India, allegedly to speak about My Vision for America. The main thing I'd say about the Bailey book is that it's really made Frank Bailey much more well-known around the United States than he was before, and perhaps even in Alaska. So it's hard to say that any of this is harmful to either Mr. Bailey or to Joe McGinnis. And
Or possibly even to Sarah Palin.
It's just more of the celebrity buzz around Sarah Palin.
Yeah. Dermot, I was going to add one thing, and you can perhaps explain a little bit of this to our viewers, and that is anytime there are stories in the newspaper about Sarah Palin, they wind up on not only newspapers, but on blogs and Google all over the place, and tens of thousands of people read them all over the United States.
That's right, Mike. And, you know, I would think that Mr. Bailey would think that, you know, any news is good news if he's going to be selling a book.
Or to refrain something Molly Ivins said, quoting a Texas legislator, "Honey, you put my name in the paper and you spelled it right." Dermot, let's stick with you. Governor Sean Parnell has been feuding with the Obama administration about so-called Obamacare. What have you discovered in your writing and extensive research? And if we're not going to have Obamacare, are we going to have Parnell Care?
Well, to back up a bit, Mike, what has happened is this. The state or the Parnell administration has applied for a series of grants under the new federal health care law since last summer and not applied for some others. The state has accepted about $14 million in grants, and it is also qualified for about $90 million in another source of money made available by the new health care law. So by my calculation, that's over $100 million. Most recently, the governor decided not to apply for a $1 million grant to help plan a health insurance exchange program. Now, this has been portrayed as refusing to enact or implement the federal health care law because of the Florida court decision that, at least temporarily, has put that it in limbo. It's really sort of a mixed picture. The state is implementing part of the federal health care law through these grants that it has applied for and received.
Okay. What about Parnell Care? The governor says we don't need the federal system or the federal takeover, as he calls it. I'm going to have my own system.
Well, he's referring to the health exchange system that has to be set up under the federal law to allow people to gain more information and to have a better choice of health care plans, health insurance plans. You know, we'll just have to wait and see what the state comes up with. I personally don't know how this grant differed substantially from the others that the state applied for and accepted. The governor will say that the grants he did apply for, he took that action before the Florida court decision. So that's one reason why it's different.
Okay. Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Paul Jenkins, Jill Burke, and Dermot Cole is joining us by telephone from Fairbanks. Jill, you had a really interesting story in the Alaska Dispatch about the interior village of Koyukuk and some of the problems it's facing and its attempt to resolve them.
Yeah, it's in a unique position in that it, but maybe not so unique when you look at the entire state. It's a small community, about 100 people, that has some needs. It needs water and sewer and some local improvements.
Koyukuk being as in associated with the Koyukuk River.
Yes, it's on the junction between two rivers. And it's had a hard time finding funding to make these things happen. And it's a good example of kind of the thicket of how well-intended policies about financial investments can sometimes strangle the life out of a community. This is what the mayor would say. So the backstory is Koyukuk is on a river. It is subject to flooding. It floods routinely. Villagers will now tell you, not bad enough that we need to relocate or do anything about it, but historically it has been bad enough that at some time some villagers said, yeah, we think moving up the hill would be a good idea. So long story short, this tiny river community is on the list of imperiled villages within the state that are in dire need of total relocation alongside other, you know, handful of other coastal communities that are facing imminent erosion by like
Shishmaref being talked about all the time.
Shishmaref, Kivalina, Newtok, literally, you know, falling off into the sea. It felt that the community recently traveled to Juneau to petition lawmakers and say, look, we need some help. We don't know how we got on this relocation list. We don't want to be on it. We want to get off of it. We feel like we're blacklisted. And in looking into this, they kind of are blacklisted. I mean, it's one of those situations where state policies and federal policies through the Government Accountability Office advise wise investment, meaning don't put too much money in irresponsibly into a community you know you're going to have to move if you can't take those structures and buildings with you. Yet at the same time, with dwindling pots of money, the priorities are existing communities first, and those are kind of competing needs. And we're hearing also, not just from Koyukuk but Kivalina, it really has created a situation where people are kind of in gridlock. They can't get what they need to shake things loose and make things happen. So I don't know what the solution is going to be for Koyukuk. They seem to have some commitments that people are trying to assist.
Yeah, probably one of the things that's going to happen is one of our U.S. senators and perhaps our congressman is going to be writing letters to the appropriate government officials and saying, get on this.
Well, we'll see. You know, we spoke with the Government Accountability Office, and they said, look, our intention was never to have communities blacklisted. In fact, the point of our reports in identifying these communities was that this is exactly what can happen, is that they fall through the cracks and the funding stops and they get left in the lurch. It also is one of the communities in Alaska that's still on honey buckets. So they have big needs, but they're proud of their community. They want to stay in place, and they're not alone.
Okay. Legislators in the oil industry, especially oil industry representatives, that is, continue to debate, discuss the ACES oil tax, and there are some pretty serious differences of opinion among the legislators themselves. Paul, where are we headed, and what do you make of the Make Alaska Competitive Coalition?
Well, I'm not sure where we're headed. We're headed for discussion in the legislature, where it's going to be very tough to convince a majority in the Senate to go along with reducing oil taxes, as Governor Parnell would have them do. The Make Alaska Competitive Coalition is a business-based, if you will, organization that says it doesn't take money from the oil industry, which will provide a voice outside the oil industry to push for ACES or Alaska's clear and equitable share oil tax revision. And I think that that's where we are at this point. People like
a lot of names and acronyms.
UAA former Chancellor Mark Hamilton,
President,
is part of this. Former Governor Tony Knowles is part of it. They basically are trying to impress upon the legislature that changes to ACES are necessary for the future of the Alaska economy. I think it was Hamilton who said we can have, you know, lots of money now and nothing later, or a sustained economy. And I think that that's what they're pushing for. The legislature, the cell in the legislature will be easier in the House and very, very tough in the Senate.
Okay, let's get Dermot back in here. Dermot, is this coalition something that's going to be effective, or is this a cast of characters that the legislators and the public have seen many times before?
Well, some of the characters are the same as in the past, but some are different. This is sort of a new version of the Faces of ACES, which is what last year's attempt was to get a change in the oil tax rate in Juneau. I think, Mike, if we just step back from this, to me the big picture here is there is a relationship between state oil taxes and the level of investment, but we have no clue what it is. We didn't know what it was in 2006, didn't know what it was in 2007 or 2008, and we still don't know what it is now. You know, if this puts the legislature in a tough spot.
Okay, and do you have any sense from your experience with the legislature and your observation if this is something the legislature will actually take up a bill this year in bill form, or is this something that'll wait till next year or a special session? Too early to tell. What's your sense?
Well, I agree with Paul that it faces an easier road in the House than it does in the Senate. I think we'd all benefit by more information on this, so that we could understand if a given change in taxes is actually going to result in more oil being in the pipeline.
And
I think assuming that that's going to happen is, that's a mistake.
And, of course, all those legislators know that given oil is at $100 a barrel or more, this is when ACES brings in its highest or higher percentage of dollars into our treasury.
we're still not at the highest point, but yes, it is. It is bringing in more at these levels. I guess over the years, Mike, it's been frustrating to me that we have not had a continuing high level of analysis to determine whether we are taxing too much or too little. I don't think anyone is saying that we are taxing too little.
Well, that there'd probably be a few of them, but what we have in lieu of that is very firm opinions. Paul, do you want to add something here?
One of the sticking points, too, here we are at this point of very high oil prices, and the legislators, the ones who kind of oppose changing ACEs, are saying, well, if we do this, and I think Dermot's right, we don't know where the point is, but if we do something, will you promise more jobs and more oil in the pipeline? And they're saying, no, we can't promise that. Oil prices drop to $47 tomorrow. It's a whole new ball game. It's all market driven.
Right.
This is going to be one of those things where it's going to be a wing and a prayer right up to the very end.
Okay.
You know, Mike, it makes you think that we need people like Pedro Van Meers to sort of explain what's going on.
Okay, and we haven't seen him for a while. Jill, Governor Sean Parnell offers his Choose Respect program to the business community. Remind us a little bit, what is Choose Respect about, and what are the what are the opportunities here for the governor?
Right. This is a public awareness campaign that he initiated last year. It is his campaign against domestic violence, sexual assault, and basically abuse of any kind, all of which have astronomically high rates throughout Alaska. And he took that message to the business community by way of the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce luncheon and addressed businesses and said, look, you have a role to play in this too. You can help us by donating in kind to help us market our message. You can help us by linking back to our campaign. More importantly, you need to be aware of the toll that abuse and violence takes in the workplace in terms of your bottom line dollars. Take a look at how much you're lost in productivity because of employees who may be subject to this abuse at home, but you're not aware of it, who are diminished in their capacity to function at work, who may be out on sick days, who may have higher health care needs. And one of the more interesting things I found was he really encouraged employers to be sensitive to the cues that may exist that one of their employees may be suffering abuse at home, that those missed days, that lack of concentration, diminished productivity might not be that they're a bad employee, but they may need some help and some intervention and some reinforcement. And so it's really another step, I believe, in his effort to get all Alaskans talking about abuse, to be aware of it, to know where they can go for help, and to bring it more out into the open.
And he has received some criticism, or at least feedback, that says this is great as moral suasion and urging us to do the right thing, but you're going to have to put some money behind a variety of projects to really get where you want to go, right?
Right. There are some people who feel that this is good in the sense that people are becoming increasingly aware, and the more aware they are, they'll be motivated to act. But there are people who are close to the problem who say we need to still be investing in more law enforcement, more education, more early intervention, more safe shelters for women and children, more total kind of comprehensive family safety nets that get involved, and that takes time, money, infrastructure, people, personnel. And so yes, the message is one thing, but there's this whole other side to it that's important too.
Okay, thank you. Alaska goes Hollywood, and that means tax credits and subsidies to the Hollywood feature film companies that come up here. Dermot, you've been following this issue very carefully. Tell us how this works, and you've raised some important questions about value and values.
Well, right now, the question of extending the film subsidies is very much alive in Juneau. There's a proposal that's advancing in the Senate, and I believe in the House as well, to double the amount set aside for subsidies from $100 million to $200 million. Of course, everybody loves whales. Did have a big impact in Anchorage last fall, and the producers say, and this is easy to believe, that the movie would not have been made in Alaska had the film subsidy program not been in existence. There was just a report this week highlighting the economic benefit basically to Anchorage from the filming of Everybody Loves Whales. But it is incomplete because we still don't know key information, such as how much of the subsidized portion of the films of the film expenses is paid to outside residents. For instance, how much of a movie star's salary ends up being subsidized by the state under this tax credit program? And I use the word subsidy because these companies aren't paying taxes in Alaska.
Yeah, could you explain that, we can't make eye contact, but the term tax credit is really a misnomer here, isn't it?
Well, yes, I believe it's really inaccurate. The companies get what are called transferable tax credits. And since the companies are not paying taxes, what they do is they sell the transferable tax credits. So in essence, it's an indirect grant from the state treasury. They sell the tax credit to a company that has to pay taxes in Alaska. So this amounts to a really attractive thing for the film industry. The question is just what is Alaska getting in exchange for the investment that it is making in the movie business? I would say that the research that was released this week is tells part of the story, but more research needs to be done.
Okay, let's hope that it is. Jill, you wanted to add something here?
Oh, I would just echo what Dermot was saying, that the tax credit program really is, I think, one way to understand it, is it's more of a rebate program. If they spend X amount of money that meets certain criteria, in-state hire, rural location, you know, X number of expenses, film in the off season, they can get up to 44% of their money back in the way of a tax credit. They can then sell that tax credit for however much money they get for it, but the state of Alaska will honor it at its face value. So it's billed as a good deal, not only for the film industry, but also for any Alaska company that might have a tax liability that's picking these up, presumably at some kind of a discount. So I do agree with Dermot that I do think that there could be more transparency in the overall process. And right now we're just kind of being asked to trust what we're being told with no real independent way to verify that. And that doesn't only apply to how the specific expenses break down and who's earning what salaries and how many of them are realistically Alaskans, but also following the tax credit from start to finish. We have this blind spot of who the ultimate end users are with zero information about them.
And that could be very confusing, certainly the general public. Meanwhile, Port of Anchorage Director Bill Sheffield goes to Juneau seeking $320 million in help to complete the expansion of the port. And Paul Jenkins, he wasn't particularly enthusiastically received.
They did not run up and hug him, that's for sure. In a year, as the Daily News has pointed out, the Daily News has had extensive coverage of the port. And it says basically that in a year when there's all these other projects out there, it's just sitting a dam, road from Point McKenzie, there's no money. There's very little money, and $320 million is much too much. So I guess the mayor, Sullivan, had asked for $20 million. Parnell had included $20 million
Parnell,
in his budget. And that's pretty much where they are. The betting is it'll go between 20 and the 320, but he's not going to get the 320. The port itself is problematic. It starts off at a $300 million effort in 2005. It's now up to $1 billion. It's 10 years delayed or 10 years behind. It doesn't present itself as something you want to sink more money in. They're talking about, well, what we can do is do revenue bonds and general obligation bonds to cover some of this. But Senator Burt Stedman, I guess, points out, I think rightly, that the port doesn't make enough money to pay for revenue bonds. So I'm not sure what they're going
to
do.
We only have a couple minutes for our final topic. Representative Sharon Cisna has her disagreements with the TSA at the Seattle airport, and she decides to find an alternative method of getting back to the state capitol in Juneau. Jill, this story has received a lot of attention. Your assessment?
Well, she's, you know, someone who has had a mastectomy. The TSA knew full body scanners detected it. They wanted to do a full body pat down. She said no because 3 months earlier she went through the exact same thing, and she felt that the pat down was so invasive that she would never subject herself to it again. And she happens to be someone who has spoken about a childhood experience of inappropriate touch, and that this triggered all kinds of emotions and feelings for her that were too traumatic. So she said no, and in saying no, she's become kind of a popular cult hero, I guess, to a degree that
you
has,
can Google her name and
yes,
find out all about
that has galvanized yeah. both the ACLU and the Tea Party in their defense of her decision and the fact that this is security measures gone too far and that there has to be a better balance between personal, liberty, control over your body, and making sure the skies are safe to fly.
Let's get Dermot Cole in here quickly. Dermot, the State House passed a resolution 36-2 supporting Representative Cisna. Tell us about it.
Well, it sort of recognizes that the personal indignity that someone is subjected to when flying, and this can happen to anyone, and it does. On the other hand, what are we going to do about, stopping some unknown person that attempts to do us harm? It's a tough situation.
Okay, and then many of us have also seen the scene where an 80-year-old person in a wheelchair is put through the ringer because they want to check out both the person and the wheelchair. Thank you for joining us here on Anchorage Edition. We'll see you next week.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.